I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. It's always fun to get your hands on the latest technological gadget, but it takes a different kind of person to look at those innovations as a way to really change the world. This hour, we'll talk with three of the innovators and idealists in town for tonight's TEDxKC event and find out how they're using technology to defy the impossible. From encouraging wider participation in science and technology to creating connections between different platforms, their ideas and more will be the focus of this year's TEDxKC. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The theme of this year's TEDxKC event, which presents tonight at the Kauffman Center, is Defy Impossible. So is it possible to design a mass transit system that overcomes one of the chief barriers to all mass transit systems? And that is this idea that mass transit runs on a schedule, and a lot of people resist schedules. The answer appears to be yes, and the impossible may have just been defied. Challenge 2, is it possible to engage young girls of color to become the computer programmers of tomorrow, given that so much of the digital revolution has bypassed certain communities? The answer, again, appears to be a resounding yes. Today, conversations with three of the participants at this year's TEDx Kansas City event, which has grown into one of the largest TED events on the planet. With us this morning is Jared Ficklin. He's a principal technologist and a fellow at Frog Design. His approach to design favors effective over expensive and form following emotion. We'll have him explain that in just a moment. And Jared, nice to have you. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you.
Kimberly Bryant is also here. She's an engineer and social entrepreneur who founded Black Girls Code, a program that introduces programming and technology to girls of color. Kimberly, nice to have you, too. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
Mike Lundgren is back. He's director of innovation strategy for Kansas City-based marketing firm VML. Mike is the founding curator of TEDxKC, and Mike, always good to have you, too.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, I wanted to begin with all of you talking about this idea that is behind the TED concept, which is, you know, the power of ideas, the power of innovation as our economy moves from a manufacturing to a service-based economy. So what's happening out there in the world of ideas, Jared? How much is going on these days?
Oh, it's enormous. Innovation has found a new voice, and that is communication. Technology and, you know, the digital lifestyles we all lead, it's given us the ability to not talk to our neighbors or our city, but actually the entire world. To me, this is really the foundation where a lot of the TEDx stuff comes. But it's really interesting is it's turned an infinite loop back in on itself. And after establishing itself as a global phenomenon of sharing ideas, it's now turned into a local focus with TEDx, where a community can come together.
Yeah.
And share their interests with the world.
You know, Kimberly, just going beyond the idea of the TED conferences, you know, what is going on in the world these days when it comes to innovation, technology, new ideas? What are you sensing as sort of afoot out there?
I think what I sense as afoot is definitely a new revolution, and that revolution being, as you mentioned before, not based on industrialism, but based on technology. So we're seeing a new generation of native learners that are young folks that have grown up with a computer, with a laptop, with an iPad, taking technology and innovation into places that we couldn't even have imagined at that same age.
How exciting is this for you as you sort of look across the landscape at what's going on out there, not just with the work you're doing, but even beyond that?
It's incredibly exciting for me because I consider myself a geek or a nerd. And so
I am
deep down inside. And so for me to see engineering and technology finally moving up to the forefront is something that any engineer kind of dreams of, because that's sort of our playground.
Yeah.
So it's very exciting.
Mike, a lot of folks may not be completely understanding of what the TEDx concept is. What is it? Talk to us about innovation, all this creative stuff that you're doing with the TED conference here.
Sure. Well, so TED, first of all, stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, I think, actually, I believe that it's long since transcended that. It's really about people and ideas, the groundbreaking work that's changing the world that we live in. And it's, you know, you're just as likely to see a celebrity on the stage as a neuroscientist or somebody like Kimberly or Jared that have an idea worth spreading.
And the foundation for the TED conference are these 18-minute talks that your speakers present. No more than 18 minutes, but that's what sort of is the focal point here, right?
It's a beautiful format, actually. 18 minutes forces you to get right to the heart of the matter.
Yeah.
And honestly, today, a lot of talks are less than 18 minutes.
Jared's nodding his head. 18 minutes. Yeah, I can't mess around here tonight, right? Yeah.
The clock's in front of you, and it's ticking down from your very first word. And it's a little imposing. But
Is the clock right in front of the speakers?
It's right there.
Mm-hmm. So you know exactly where you stand every moment of the evening then.
Yeah, it's you go over 18 minutes and you lose your eligibility to be on TED.com. And so that's kind of a great carrot and a stick.
Really?
Yeah.
So this is serious.
It's very serious.
Got to keep it to 18 minutes or else here, eh? So this thing is going to be held tonight at the Kauffman Center. And you're going for a number of hours, right?
Yeah, we begin at 6 p.m. We're encouraging people to show up at 5 p.m. actually when the outer doors open. There's registration and pickup. And at 5:30, the inner doors open. It's general admission by section, so people are encouraged to kind of take their seats then. And we'll go to about 9 p.m., and there's a reception after that.
Jared, this whole thing has become more than just people going to listen to 18-minute talks. There's sort of it's become a cultural phenomenon of some kind. Describe what that's all about. What is that?
Absolutely. No, it's people seeking out almost a form of education or even philosophical inspiration.
Yeah.
You know, with the new media is changing this format that I could make a personal connection with you through a video. It happens, and that leads to inspiration. And to me, it feeds what I would call the adhocracies. And that's it. A lot of people are passionate about a topic, and they don't know how to find other people who are also passionate about it. So one of the outcomes, I think, of this phenomenal thing is you speak about your passion, and next thing you know, you're connected with a lot of people who are passionate about it as well. And you become a force to make it real or to have an impact or spread an inspiration. So it's not just consumption. There's a whole other side of it afterwards where it turns into action.
Mike, is it mostly young folks who are showing up for these things? 20-somethings?
It certainly attracts a younger audience, but I'm always surprised to see, really everybody from every walk of life and every age show up. And, 5 or 6 years ago when you talked about TED, typically people were a little unsure. Is there somebody named TED?
Where's TED?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, where's Waldo?
But the last few years, it's really taking off. I mean, you can hear TED Talks on the radio. You can stream them live on Netflix. You can watch them on YouTube. You can go to TED.com as well. And it's become a bit of its own phenomena, and it's exciting because it's a culture that's about the idea of ideas, and what a brilliant pop culture for that to be.
There's a public radio program now based on the TED series that might be coming to KCUR here at some point pretty soon. People are looking at it here and like what they hear.
Yeah, it's brilliant for radio, actually. Kind of made for radio.
Made for radio, absolutely. Okay. Jared, I wanted to turn to you to begin for a minute to talk about your own approach to design, which is the value you place on effective over expensive and the need for form to follow emotion. I pretty much get that first part, but explain the whole form following emotion, because I thought the dictum was for form to follow function.
Oh, yeah.
So what are you talking about?
Well, form follow emotion is a saying that and a credo, really, that comes from Hartmut Esslinger, who founded Frog many, many years ago in the Black Forest of Germany before it came to the United States. And Hartmut is most famous for his role in the industrial design for the early Apple products. And there was a real movement afoot at that point that the product shape and how it felt in your hands really did not no longer need to be a commodity of function, that really to be differentiated it needed to have a personal attachment to a person. So form needed to follow emotion. And in the modern era, I've taken that credo to heart. And I think it goes beyond that. We now live in an era where so many products have no form at all. Mm-hmm. They're services, or they're things that you log on to, or they're part of your lifestyle. But those things also need to have an emotional connection. And I think we can go right back around to the infrastructures of our cities and our houses. Mm-hmm. And those can also follow this emotional path.
How do you create emotion in the internet world? How do you grab people through in an emotional way by just going online?
Well, you know, you need to take a form of their digital lifestyle, something that they're seeking to do, and give it the kind of elegance, personality, and craft that they're seeking. So We all carry our own patinas around. Everyone has a favorite handbag, right? It's their favorite handbag, not just because of the brand and the materials, but because of the scratches it's picked up or how it's worn in.
Yeah.
Well, that's a very hard thing to achieve digitally. But you'll see it in things like Instagram or Hipsomatic, right? These are not just ways to make photos beautiful. That's the treatment I put on there. It exudes my personality as it goes out as an artifact into the digital tribes.
That's interesting.
And therefore, I am more connected to it emotionally. What will be really interesting is in the future when we start having more memory and history with these systems, to where that photograph or that MP3 could acquire a scratch. Something that made it, you know, more historical to that moment in time,
more authentic
and more personal
or whatever.
To me.
Yeah, that's interesting. I want to turn to your talk tonight about mass transit. I was hoping you were going to say that, you know, you're at TEDx events this year, you turn your attention to mass transit, which is all well and good, but I was hoping you were going to say that flying cars were finally here. I'm guessing that's a no, right?
No. That's flying cars is a metaphorical statement there in this case. Really, what I was trying to indicate with the title that we were promised flying cars is that we are on a cusp of technology changes that are really going to have an impact on infrastructures. And it allows us a new way to look at building things like mass transit. Before, it was an engineering problem, and it's just approached that way. What systems exist? How do they lay out? Where can they go?
But light rail, streetcars, that kind of thing.
It's always buses. Trains and buses.
Yeah, right.
But what about the user and the experience they're looking for? You know, and where do they come into the equation? And how can newer technologies begin to help them? And that's important because if they embrace it, you have adoption. Then if you have adoption, you have use. And one of the things I like to say is the most expensive system anyone can build in the area of mass transit is one that no one uses.
That's interesting. You know, the idea, you know, mass transit is so popular on the coasts, by necessity perhaps, not very popular here in the heartland, where at least in this town we have struggled with mass transit issues for decades, just really having trouble figuring it out. So my question is, why do folks pack buses and subways out east, but they don't do that here in the heartland? What's missing from the experience for them?
There's a real social factor to it. And we went out and did a bunch of design research. We talked to people, and we found that the Northeast is profoundly different from the West and the South of the United States. If you look at the way the cities grew up in history, new places like New York, they had a 200-year history before the automobile. They were laid out, and they're set in their course and their path before it was even invented. Also, though, think of the trends of immigration. New York City had these huge influxes of immigration, basically people moving from cities to a city. Mm-hmm. They were acculturated to a tighter form of personal space and an urban living. The people who didn't like that way of living, they manifested destiny, so to speak.
They came out here.
They went west, and they carried with them a different cultural perspective. When you talk to them, they have different perceptions of individuality and personal space that has ramifications to the transportation area. They want more personal space, and they have a severe dislike for scheduling. Also, the cities themselves, they grew up differently. They had 50 years of history of horse and buggy, and then 100 years of history of the romantic era of the automobile, and that brings us to today.
So how do you incorporate those ideas, people's dislike of scheduling, people's dislike here in the heartland of crowded spaces, people being packed together? How do you translate into a mass transit system that might be more appealing here in Kansas City?
Right. So if I was building a product, I would look for what experiences people are wanting from it and distill that to the core. It's the same thing here. People are looking for a lack of scheduling and more personal space. So if you then go out and look for technologies that offer that, that aren't old world technology that have to run on a schedule, then you stand a greater chance of these people adapting their lifestyle to it. And there are technologies that can do that. There's one of them that is called Urban Cable that comes out of the ski industry, and another one that is an exclusive for your show, because I'm not including this in my talk. But if you think of self-driving cars being on the cusp and imagine them pulling together into road trains, what's the difference between an inner city train carrying 200 people and a dozen smart cars traveling together 5 inches apart carrying 200 people? So if you take technology, suddenly you can say, like, oh, the mission here is to get a person from here to here. And guess what? I could do it in a style that they actually want to
do
it.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
Urban cable is one that fits more into like a
density.
What is
urban? It's like gondolas, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I keep saying urban cable. These are
That's a hipper way to say it.
It's a hipper way.
That's the difference between us here.
Yeah, yeah. I like to call it the wire, actually. not everyone's been to a ski area, so if I were to describe it to you, these are 4 or 6 person enclosed cars. They hang on a cable. They have mechanics that make them detachable, so they can travel at 12 to 15 miles per hour, but they can come off the cable. They slow down. The doors open. You walk yourself on. You walk off. They're across a flat level platform. You actually wheel a wheelchair or a bike right onto these things as well, and you leave. Now, think of it as a subway broken up and put up in the air. Mm-hmm. It lays out like a subway, but for a lot less cost than a subway.
Yeah.
But it's individual. It's as if you broke the subway up into a bunch of car-sized compartments and started flying them around.
So basically you're talking about ski lifts, putting ski lifts between Midtown, Kansas City, and the suburbs or something like
that. Well, ski lift would lead to a whole bunch of dropped iPhones. But and that could be a problem.
Yeah.
But instead, if you enclose the car, insulate it, engineer it so that it has climate control, this becomes a system that's a lot more oriented towards mass transit. The ski areas, some interesting things when you think about a ski area and why this technology is so interesting. They have to set it up in 3 months, right? So it's modular in construction. They have to run it on a very thin budget, right? And they have to move a lot of people very quickly, and they can't have a schedule for it. No one's going to wait at the bottom of the hill till 8:15 to go up the top mountain to ski down. They want to ski down, get on, and go. Now, they can pare their budget back because they're only dealing with one season, and the people are adventurous enough to ride on open, flat seats. But take that same engineering, that inspiration about moving a lot of people without a schedule, and engineer it for an urban setting, and that's what I would call urban cable.
I mean, can you run those urban cables? Can you run them 10 or 15 miles to accommodate sort of the vast sprawl of Kansas City, which, again, you don't have to accommodate all of it, but certainly the center part of the city where so many folks live. Can it run for 10 or 15 miles?
At the speeds that it's running, you could, but it really wouldn't compete with a car at that point. And those kind of lengths are a lot more suitable for something like light rail. Where it works a lot better is as a central circulator or to jump over bottlenecks. So in the 1 to 5 mile range, there are systems that use multiple cables that can move all the way up to 35 miles an hour. But the central circulator, and one of the reasons you might consider this is like they're up in the air. So they don't take away street capacity, right? They don't displace existing traffic. They're an additive solution in nature. This creates a lot of freedom in routing, though. That's the hardest part with fitting mass transit into a city core is routing. Where in the heck do you put it? So many streets are so small.
Yeah.
But if you can go over things, or you can fly under bridges, or you can fly over rivers or freeways, suddenly a whole possibility of routing opens up. And now you can look more at putting the routes where the people want to go rather than where the equipment will fit. That's another one of those social keys for adoption.
You know, Mike Lundgren will know this as well as I do, that there's some history in Kansas City of this idea of gondolas being run in town. A guy named Clay Chastain, who's been our transit activist in this town for years, proposed the idea a number of years ago of putting up an urban cable system essentially between the Liberty Memorial and Union Station. It was sort of part of a much larger plan he presented. And a lot of folks sort of laughed him out of town just based on the gondola idea alone. But you're saying, hey, wait a minute, there's something to it.
Very much. I don't know him. He sounds like a kindred spirit. There's been some engineering changes, though.
He's that a whole lot more, Jared. Let me just assure you of that. Yeah.
Two things you said are very correct. Part of a system. There's no single solution for mass transit. They all end up being additive solutions. It's about the best solution for getting people from the point to point in the way that they want to go it. But there's been a lot of engineering changes in the last decade that have made it something that's kind of worth considering, air conditioning being one of them.
Yeah.
The whole industry has kind of built out the ski industry, so now they're focusing on urban, so they've re-engineered systems. And there's actually a lot of systems built out there today. There's many cities around the world, especially in South America, that are using this as a transportation system. Medellin in Colombia is a great case study. They have a three-line system.
I've heard about that. Steven Steigman, our producer, has been there and talks about it very fondly. Yeah.
He told me he rode around it all day.
Mm-hmm.
It's a common thing. But what it's really used for is these neighborhoods that built up so dense that you couldn't even get a bus into them, and they're totally underserved. And public transportation via the wire has been a way to transform them. Rather than plow down a whole row of houses to get a thoroughfare in, they just put down one stop, hop people over to the existing trains and buses.
Yeah.
And it's really been a key factor in stimulating investment, in having a sense of local pride in the residents, and it's really starting to turn around the community. Very effective.
And Mike, I'm guessing, too, that sitting up there in one of those cable cars would be a pretty pleasant experience.
So I've ridden many of these, and a fun case study is the Roosevelt Island Tram, because you can get there on the subway in Manhattan, which is a rather, for me, being a Western kid growing up in the Southwest, a bit of a violent experience.
Right.
A lot of shaking and noise. It removes two of your senses. You no longer have the sense of hearing, and you feel like you don't have a sense of feel because you're being moved around, and you're crowded in with more people. I mean, the New Yorkers are used to this, but for me, it's like, oh, I feel like I have to keep my hand on my wallet, my iPhone, because I'm just not used to it. It's not my cultural predilection. But then you get on the tram. It's also shoulder to shoulder. A tram is a much bigger thing, like a bus in an air, holds 170 people.
Right.
But it's quiet. It's peaceful. It's like it's floating. So you're all standing there reading your Kindle, acknowledging each other's existence in a much different way. It's the same way like a noisy schoolyard of children, or like a really bustling mall with teenagers, or the library all feel differently.
But you're selling this thing pretty well, and I need to get our listeners to respond here and get their two cents on what you think of this idea of urban cable or a gondola system in Kansas City as part of a larger mass transit system for our town. Give us a shout. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address is uptodate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us @kcuruptodate. So have you talked about this idea much here in Kansas City, and what kind of reaction have you gotten?
Well, I'm kind of going to be provocative and introduce the city to it at TEDx here. It sounds like I'm not the first introduction, but a reintroduction. I have walked around your downtown. I've taken cabs, and I've been on your buses since I've been here for 2 days.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of excellent opportunities here for it.
Mm-hmm.
You have these amazing downtown space that is kind of surrounded by what I would call bottlenecks, rivers and bridges and freeways. These are the hard places. You have a pretty interesting transportation plan out there as well. I think it's better than a lot of other cities, your transportation infrastructure. But one of the things I saw that's really interesting is your downtown is all these almost neighborhoods, and then there are these massive infrastructure blocks between them, either a freeway crossing or a big convention center.
Yeah.
And, man, I look at Wyandotte, I'm like, what a great place to put urban cable. I could get on. I'd be down here in, 6 minutes and – just walk right off. It could ride perfectly, and you could connect all the neighborhoods and the big infrastructure pieces and make it a more comfortable pedestrian city.
Has any other U.S. city, significant size city, done this in our country?
No, we're looking for first. Other than trams, which are these point-to-point flying buses, which are there's one in Portland and there's one in – it's only been like small ski towns that have used it as a cost-cutting measure. Rather than run shuttles and city bus systems, they just looked up their hill and said, what are we doing? Let's bring those down, put them flat, and use that as a cost-saving measure.
Trams being just that goes from one point to the next point and back again along the same route. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, if I were to illustrate the difference between detachable gondolas and trams. Trams are these large things that do, they swing back and forth, and they're used to connect, like a, the one in Brooklyn was used while they were building the subway. While they were building underneath the river, they put this tram in. So you'd ride the subway, go on the tram, and go off. Then they opened the subway, and in the 70s, they closed down the tram. But in recent days, they went back in and rehabilitated and opened the tram because it's just a better experience.
Well, Jared, your enthusiasm for this is infectious. Kansas City, what do you think of this idea of urban cable gondolas going from one point in our town to another? 816-235-2888. Diana from Kansas City, Kansas, good morning.
Good morning. I am actually a native Colombian, and I was just listening to your guys' show, which
yeah,
is great.
Great.
And I am from Manizales. I heard that you were talking about Medellin. And actually, in Manizales, it's a very small city, and we also have the gondola system, which is actually expanding. It's something new, but it's expanding, and it's a great success. My question is, you know, in South America, and we're located around along the Andes, we have a very extreme topography, which I see as very, you know, nice and easy to put a gondola system going through. But for Kansas City, you know, it's pretty flat. So mm-hmm. I was wondering how that would work here in Kansas. And I'll take the answer off the phone.
Sure. Diane, I'm glad you called. Thank you. How is our flatness going to affect all this?
Well, there are systems like Barcelona has a system that many places it only runs a foot or so above the ground. It's about transportation. Certainly mountains offer the kind of geographic barrier that this was made for. But the other geographic barriers are like rivers. Like, how do you get across a river? Usually you build a $225 million bridge. But a gondola can span a river for no extra cost. Freeways are another one. Anytime you're looking to route under, over, around a freeway, very expensive, you can fly a gondola over. So its ability to go up in the air actually is what creates a lot of the routing options, as well as its ability to climb mountains. So that's where the advantages come from. So it is just about twisting that imagination.
And it goes without saying, this would be a far less expensive way to transport people than building a fixed rail in our streets, that kind of thing.
Well, the construction is significantly less because you're only touching the points where the towers and
yeah.
the stops are. The rest of it is modular equipment that can be built with all the economies of scale off-site, and it's brought in and bolted down. And if you're not having to do things like move utilities for, you know, a 60-ton implement or train or bus, then you can save that money as well, and the bridge costs as well. In my hometown of Austin, we had that figure. We were looking to run streetcar across a very small river compared to the Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And that bridge was slated to cost $225 million just for the bridge. And you could do that. You could just eliminate that fee.
Well, Mike, you're already succeeding with your TED concept here. What an interesting idea. Would you want to take a urban cable from, you know, where we are now, maybe to the plaza or elsewhere?
You know, the last caller's comment about Kansas City being flat, actually,
yeah.
I think that's one of the most interesting things about this concept is anybody who's been about the sixth floor anywhere in Midtown and taken a look around, it's really a beautiful city from that altitude.
Yeah.
And the concept of having the wire or urban cable, you know, land on the rooftop, you know, at that height, and you could step out and into a retail experience or, you know, into a parking garage. I think it's a new way of seeing Kansas City. I think it's pretty exciting, actually.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the TEDx Kansas City conference taking place tonight at the Kauffman Center. The event is sold out, but there are ways for you to take part and watch what's going to be happening tonight. Just go to our website, kcur.org, for more information. Mike, what are we listening to here?
This is Chris Perica. She'll be performing tonight, actually. She has recently been featured on the Showtime series Shameless, and you know, she's performed with a number of amazing musicians. But when she takes the stage with her two compatriots, it's engaging and wonderful. It's really going to be a treat for Kansas City.
Okay, let's take a break. We'll listen to Chris Perica. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking today about the TEDx Kansas City Conference. It's sort of a newfangled concept of bringing people together with new ideas, looking at the future, innovative ideas, new ideas about design and the way we live our lives. I want to bring Kimberly Bryant into our conversation. She's been waiting very patiently here. Again, she's an engineer and a social entrepreneur who founded this program, Black Girls Code. That's a program that introduces programming and technology to girls of color. Kimberly, you are an engineer and a social entrepreneur who founded this program. How did you get the idea for Black Girls Code?
Steve, the idea was really driven by my need as, or my desire as a mother to find some creative ways for my then 12-year-old daughter to engage with technology rather than just playing computer and video games all day.
So yeah.
She, unlike what the stats say, she's a huge video game junkie. She was then and she still is.
I know some of those kids in my own house, as a matter of fact, Kimberly. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I was really getting frustrated and even a little bit annoyed with her continually playing games day in and day out. And I really wanted her to do something creative with the technology as opposed to just consuming so much of it.
And so you did what?
So I looked around and on the Bay Area looking for an opportunity for her to attend some type of training camp. And I found one at Stanford. It was fantastic. But the unfortunate thing about that class, or a little bit disappointing, was that there were only about 3 girls in that class out of a class of about 40 or so odd boys. And the girls didn't always get as much attention from the teacher as probably I would have liked and she would have liked.
You were sitting in there. You could see it yourself.
No, she told me.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
So, you know, after class, after the week of, you know, being on campus, I was like, how was the class? She was like, great. But, you know, the teacher didn't always call on the girls, et cetera. So I really was a little bit afraid that she would get discouraged. And I was like, oh, I need to find something that is an environment that she can be comfortable in and will really encourage her to continue to learn and build on these tools she's gaining.
And so you did what?
So I took a pivot of trying to start a startup company myself, which I was doing at the time, and decided to focus on creating an organization that would be a nurturing environment for girls that look like my daughter or girls that look like me 40 years ago. And really plant little seeds about technology, robotics, et cetera, mobile app development that would engage them and get them excited about building things with technology and not just using them.
Now, a lot of parents wouldn't go to that much effort.
Mm-hmm.
And you did it because why?
I did it because that's really my story. So I graduated from college in the mid to late 80s. And to see the industry really decline in terms of women in the 40 years when we're at a boom was really discouraging because there weren't that many of us there when I attended college, and now there are even less. And I have a daughter that's coming up in my footsteps. So it was something I had to do because that was my story. And then I'm raising a child that's going in my footsteps, and I wanted that environment and that path for her to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Different than what, and not just different, but even better than what I experienced.
So Black Girls Code is the organization you founded.
Yes.
What is it?
Black Girls Code is a nonprofit, and we focus on training girls, girls of color, that's African American, Latinas, and Native American students, to really engage with technology. Start at 7, we go all the way up to 17.
We
start at 7.
You catch them right out of a gate. Then.
Absolutely. We've even had girls as young as 6. So we think it's important to start them as young as possible and really give them a full view of everything from robotics to mobile design to web design. We want them to see it all because we never know what's going to really plant a spark in each individual student.
And so where is this program located?
Well, we started out in the Bayview, Hunters Point area of San Francisco,
yeah,
and we quickly expanded. So from 2011 to date, we have 7 chapters currently, from Atlanta, Chicago, Detroit, New York, Memphis, Tennessee, which is my hometown, to Las Vegas.
And it grew because why? People heard about this and said, give me some of that? Or
absolutely.
Is that what happened? Yeah.
Absolutely. So we originally didn't know where this would go. We didn't even know if girls would like what we were offering. And the response was overwhelming. So we saw, and we still get literally request on a day-to-day basis. I got one this morning for Kansas City, someone wanting to start a chapter here. And I was like, okay, do you know I'm here? Because I haven't met anybody.
I'm just down the street.
I just walked into my hotel.
They're probably outside the door right now, just waiting for it to get off the set here.
Absolutely. Yeah. But we, on a daily basis, we get requests from all over, even out of the country in Africa and Latin America, about starting a chapter in new cities every day.
And the requests are coming from, I gather, adults. But they're based on the interest level they're sensing from their kids, or is it just the adults thinking, this is what I want my daughter to be into?
Well, a lot of the parents come from my perspective as a parent and having a child that's very interested in technology, but wanting to find ways to get them more on the creative side of it. But I also get women that are very much like me, that are either in school now for computer science and they're the only one and they want to change that. Or women that have gone to school and graduated with a degree 20, 30 years ago and they want to do something. They want to see the industry change to be more reflective. So it comes from all different areas. But we even get dads, you know, so I don't want to say that it's just women that want this, but I have so many dads that want to create opportunities for their daughters in technology and to see other women in the field that they're in currently. So,
and just to be clear, these are classes for girls only, right?
Girls only, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So we're gender specific in that we only allow girls in most of our classes, although we've done some events, co-ed events as well. But we really focus on creating environments where girls can thrive and be encouraged.
And the idea behind that is if girls are just amongst other girls, they'll tend to thrive more because they're not distracted by good-looking guys like me,
the way you say that, Steve. Yeah. I like that self-confidence.
I personalize everything here, Kimberly. No, it's my show, and it all comes back to me.
I like it. Yeah. But some of that. But I think also we found that in our classes, girls tend to interact in ways a little bit different than girls. They're very social beings overall, so they love interacting and building things in a team-based environment, whereas, you know, boys might be more individually drawn. And they are more creative, and their interests are more social in terms of what they build and really trying to build things that change the world, so to speak.
You've been doing this just finished your first year, right?
Yes, just a little over 2 years. We're in our second year currently.
Yeah, and how many of the girls who completed the first year, and are these classes taking part like after school or how does it work? Yeah.
Yes, it's mainly after school program, and we also do summer camps. So during the summer, we do week-long summer camps, primarily in the Bay Area. But it all takes place after school. And we have probably, I would say, 75% of our girls take repeated classes. So they'll come to class after class after class, and they continue to learn. So we really see them grow and gain new skills as they go along.
Let me get our listeners to chime in here. Are you interested in seeing a chapter of Black Girls Code in Kansas City? What do you make of this idea? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address is updatedate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us @kcurupdate. And by all means, if you want to chime in our conversation about our first half today with Jared Fitkin about gondola-style mass transit in Kansas City, we'd like to hear your thoughts about that as well. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. So you take the class after school, and
yes.
Is it 3-4 days a week, or how does it work?
It's normally on Saturdays, but sometimes we go – most of our classes are build a web page in a day or build a mobile app in a day. So it's a day-long class from 10 to 4. Girls come in and they engage in a specific topic over the course of that day. But we also have some sessions that go for multiple Saturdays where they'll come in for 6 or 7 Saturdays and really – do a deep learning experience on a particular topic.
How do you find the teachers to do it?
All of them, I would say, I don't want to say all of them, but I would say almost 90% of them are working software engineers in industry.
Are they volunteering their time?
They're volunteer their time.
No kidding.
Yep. So we really have, you know, we were lucky to be founded in a Bay Area where we're literally surrounded by technology companies. So we probably have over 600 volunteers on our rolls now across the U.S., and most of them are working software engineers and a lot of teachers now as well.
That's just amazing. So, again, you're in 6 cities now?
7 cities.
7 cities.
Plus Johannesburg, South Africa, 1 international chapter.
Would I be able to understand one of your classes, like, say, for a 15-year-old? Could I hang with it at this point in my life?
Anybody can hang with it. Anybody can hang with it. But I think the kids could probably teach you a thing or two as well.
Could they really?
Absolutely.
You're going on robotics or whatever?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here again. 816-235-2888. Our guest again, Kimberly Bryant, talking about Black Girls Code. She's part of the TEDx Kansas City event taking place tonight at the Kauffman Center. Karen from Kansas City, Missouri. Karen, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Go
my
ahead.
Question
yeah.
Why black girls? Why not all girls? I think that there's an issue with technology with all girls.
Why just black girls? Or is it just black girls?
Well, for our organization, we have a focus on girls of color because we're the least represented. So when you look overall at the statistics, women in general probably incorporate about 18%. And we've seen some anecdotal evidence that it's closer to 14% of those graduating with degrees in computer science. But if you look at women of color specifically, that number drops precipitously. So for black women, that's 3%. If you look at Latinas and Native American, it's less than 1%. So there's a problem overall for women in the field of technology. But for women of color, it's a really dire problem. It's definitely something that needs an extra degree of focus.
Let me just ask, so if someone like Karen, I don't know if she's white or not, but if you are a white parent and you have a daughter and you are interested in engaging your kid in a program like yours, which sounds so incredible, can you connect to it or not?
Absolutely. So we have a diversity of students in our classes all the time. So I literally just came from Detroit on this past Saturday, and our class was diverse. So we had all students from all ethnic creeds and colors in that particular class.
So you're not turning away white girls?
No, we don't. Our class is really open to – the only thing that we do turn away is boys. So the class is supposed to be focused on girls. But it doesn't matter, you know, what her race is. We do welcome all girls in our classes.
Karen, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Okay. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org. You can also tweet us @KCUR UpToDate. What's your own profession? Tell us a little bit more about what you do yourself.
So my background is in electrical engineering. So I am a really true hard hat wearing, steel toe shoe wearing engineering. So I spent most of my career in pharmaceutical and manufacturing industry on the factory floor in chemical plants and manufacturing plants, doing a lot of design, and I loved it. I did a little coding, but not a lot, until I really saw my daughter starting to get in technology and really discovered that skill that I have forgotten.
Is Black Girls Code now your full-time
It
job?
Is. It is. So this is what I do full time now. I do miss engineering, but it's such a rewarding experience to see young women really discover these new talents.
I bet. What happens when the light bulb goes off? I imagine
you've
seen it a bunch.
You actually see it. We talked about it in the class just on Saturday as we were teaching these new concepts, and they would get it. Their eyes light up, and you know, they just get this array of excitement in the class about learning something new and understand that they can achieve it. So that's what makes it all worthwhile for both myself as well as the instructors.
I'm wondering if Black Girls Code says something about the need for splitting the genders when it comes to education in junior high school in particular. Do you advocate that, or is that not really where you're at?
I'm probably not the best person to ask that question, because I'm the mom that sent my daughter to an all-girls middle school because I thought she needed to be in that environment to really thrive. Mm-hmm. So I do believe girls will eventually have to go into co-ed environments. So it's not our intent to create single-sex environment for the girls and paint an unrealistic expectation of what they'll receive in the work world. But it's to give them that added array of confidence so that when they do go to college and they're only student, or when they do go into the workplace like I did and they're the one woman supervisor in a crew of 25, 50 guys, that they have the confidence that they can complete the job, that they have the skill sets available.
I mean, ultimately, Kimberly, you want to change the paradigm here.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Switch the way people think about girls, black girls, whatever, and their potential for these kinds of high-tech industries.
Right. I'm looking to change not only the outside perception, but their self-perception of their abilities.
That's so cool.
Yes.
I get it completely. Let's go back to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Imani from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Kimberly, I just want to say bless you. I have been trying to do this in the Kansas City area down on 18th and Vine for the last 13 years. And my problem has been twofold. One is that I have been having a hard time getting people to understand the concept, to understand the need for the concept. I've been having a hard time getting the right people to work with. People do not believe black girls are capable of doing this. And it breaks my heart because when children are able to do something like this, just even to be able to write a small program and make it execute and make it do something, they get excited about learning everything. Mm-hmm. Math, English, science, physics, they get excited about learning everything. And I really wish you could tell me what I can do to get started doing something like that here.
I was going to say, Kimberly, how can Imani connect with you and your organization?
I would definitely love for Imani to reach out to us. She can reach out to me directly on blackgirlscode.com, and I'd love to continue the conversation. But I also want to just offer a little bit of advice. For us, one of the biggest things that really fueled our success, it was the ability to connect with advocates. So when we had a program with only 12 girls and folks started to hear about us, a company called ThoughtWorks, Inc. in San Francisco reached out and really incubated our program, provided mentors to come in and teach our classes, provided facilities to host our classes. They really gave us that added support to kind of help us grow, to find our way, and then we took off from there. So finding an advocate in the community like that is very, very important for Imani to do. That may be a corporation, that may be another community organization, but advocates is what it's all about in building that community from there.
You know, Imani, I'm guessing you can get that done.
Well, the thing is that I've been trying to do this for 13 years. I've been going to search for advocates, mentors, people to volunteer. The people in Kansas City do not believe in black girls to the extent that they would do something like that. That's my problem.
You know, that's hard for me to hear, and I got to tell you, I'm not sure I completely believe it, Imani. I bet there's a company.
From my experience.
I hear you.
From my experience trying to do this 13 years, this has been my experience.
Well, hopefully you can hook up with Black Girls Code via online and see what you can do. Mike Lundgren, hop in here.
You know, Imani, I'd like you to join us tonight if you can, by the way. I'd like you to meet Kimberly in person and have a chance to talk to her. So if you're free this evening, let's get your contact details off the air, and I'll make sure two tickets are left for you at the door.
And Stephen Steigman's going to jump on the line right now, Imani, and take your information. So thank you for calling. Let's go to Jill from Leawood. Jill, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to applaud you, Kimberly. I'm very excited about what you're doing. And I am the mother of two daughters, 9 and 10, and I'm very interested in finding out, until we have something like that here in the Kansas City area, how can someone that lives in another state other than where you have bases participate? Are there ways through the summer camp? Are there other ways that they can participate possibly?
Absolutely. So for BGC, we don't currently have any of our programs online, but we're looking at doing that in the future. But until that time, there's like many, many open source tools that you should tap into. One of our advocates and one of our community partners is called Mozilla. They have a full suite of tools for web design that teaches Java, that really helps kids at the ground level learn about coding. There's,
could you please spell that?
Sure. It's Mozilla .com. And you can find so many tools there that really get girls excited about coding. It's accessible, and they'll get it, and they'll continue to learn and grow with that. You could also look at scratch.org, and they have tools there. Also App Inventor, and those are all open source tools that are readily available for kids to do online and that you can also learn along with them.
I have another question. This escaped me at this moment, but you mentioned camps. Are people from out of state able to attend your camps in the Bay Area?
Absolutely, they are. One of the things that we have had a very successful camp This was our second year. The first year we did robotics. This year we did mobile app and entrepreneurship, and it was extremely successful. So for 2014, we're hoping to move that outside of the Bay Area and expand upon it and do more work here in the Midwest, the middle of the U.S. So if you can look onto our website, you'll find more information there, hopefully.
Well, Kimberly, Brian has lit the match, has struck the fuse, and this thing, board is lit up completely. Leslie from Kansas City, Missouri. Leslie, go quickly. We're getting short of time here.
Sure. I actually had the exact opposite experience as Imani has had. I'm working on a business media technology training program here in the urban core of KCMO, and I'm getting lots of support for it. So I'm hoping maybe she and I can connect at some point. But I was just wondering about any tips, that I might take away from the experience that your guest has had and maybe avoid some of the mistakes or benefit from her experience.
All right, Leslie.
Be willing to pivot. So test things out. Don't have to be 100% sure of your model at the time. Just test different models out and see what really resonates with your community and go from there.
Okay. We'll have to leave our conversation there. What an interesting conversation. Mike Lundgren, Jared Ficklin, Kimberly Bryant all speak tonight at the TEDxKC Defy Impossible event at the Kauffman Center. More information about that and all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Thank you all for coming in. What a great time. Good conversation. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
You bet. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Well, it was called Bleeding Kansas for a reason, and perhaps the most famous one was Quantrill's raid on Lawrence. Tomorrow on the program, we'll take a look at the massacre from the original border war on its 150th anniversary. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.